There Is One by Gutmann Locks. Part 3 of 6. 54. Consider. The mind that is experiencing difficulty can find peace through the experience of joy. With a concerted effort, one can direct the mind to be filled with healthy thoughts. Soon these thoughts will become the habitual mindset and life will improve. For example, a person who always views things in a negative light can change his point of view by introducing positive thoughts and dwelling upon these. The rest is automatic. The mind will follow the positive lead as easily as it followed the negative one. It is imperative to force the first step in order to break the habit. Then it becomes easier to take the second. The mind itself is indifferent to what type of activity it is engaged in. Its only concern is that it be active. When one tries to calm it, it can squeal like a cornered animal, making even more noise than it did when left alone. To ignore an agitated or persistently negative mind is rather difficult, since its opinions are always forced to the forefront, and the I, as in I am, will eventually form an attitude similar to that persuasion. Then the I will anticipate the next experience and almost invariably view it in the same light. Next, the body will shape itself to reflect the mind's lead. For instance, a boasting mindset will have an agreeable I direct the body to puff out its chest or to stand artificially straight, while a sad or depressed mindset will eventually cause the body to slump heavily. A happy person with head held high, comfortably walking lightly, easy to smile, and quick to say yes, is reflecting his mindset as well as the depressed person who thuds along in a stiff, hardened body. Working with the physical body can also help to turn an unwanted mental condition into a desirable one. For instance, a person who is slumping with depression can improve his mental outlook by placing his body in the stance of a happy or positive person. Do not imagine that a sad person can become optimistic by simply standing straight. However, it will definitely help, especially when it is used in connection with the other techniques, such as flooding the mind with happy, optimistic thoughts. As it says, enter his gates with thanksgiving and his courts with praise. 55. Consider, what is the atheist saying? That there is no kindly old man with a long white beard writing in a daily ledger or sitting upon a luxurious cloud? Most would agree that this definition does not really fit reality. However, this anthropomorphic description of God has a base in reality that makes it quite acceptable. With the understanding that everything is actually for the good, we can judge life to be kindly. One who does not enjoy an overview will consider each act separately, and pessimistic existentialism will be his reality. With a broader perspective, we find order in the universe. The description continues with old man. Old implies fatherhood. Man symbolizes a king. A long white beard implies ancient wisdom. The book shows that our deeds are recorded in the universal record, and when they come back upon our heads, it will testify why. Nothing escapes the watchful eye. The cloud indicates the transcendental. The atheist is difficult to convince because he is partially correct. In his simplistic understanding, he thinks the Torah teaches that God is a super other. Since he believes there is no other being called God, he is partially right. There is no other at all. If he would grasp the truth that all of creation and all of existence is but a simple one, it does not matter if he calls the all God or one or it. Recognition of omnipresence is the recognition of a supreme being. 56. Consider, man is placed in the Garden of Eden. Just as this was true for Adam and Eve, the first man and woman, so it is true for us today. Mankind is placed in a paradise and charged to tend and keep it. In this garden, there's a single tree from which he is warned not to eat. This is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. He is told that on the day that he eats the fruit of this tree, he will die. What is this death that knowing right and wrong produces? When the first man ate this fruit, his physical death did not occur until hundreds of years later. So what does this warning mean? The death of he who eats of this tree is the death of man from paradise, and what continues is man in exile. The immediate death is a spiritual one, a death of innocence and the birth of judgment. The exile is the expulsion of man from the Garden of Eden. This is a spiritual expulsion which comes about as man begins to judge as good or evil what he had previously seen to be simply God's handiwork. The garden is the same physical place before and after man's exile. Man need not physically move to go into spiritual exile. The physical Garden of Eden and the physical land of expulsion are the exact place where man is today. We're initially placed in an exquisite paradise, a garden beyond dreams, a life where all of our needs are met without having to sweat for our sustenance. However, this peaceful paradise can be instantly transformed into a jungle of death and shame. The exiled man becomes disenfranchised because he judges his environment and must therefore react to his judgments. Living in goodness, he exalts and climbs high. His place is glorious. Living in evil, he curses and tumbles into the nightmare, a continual heaving and swallowing, smiling and frowning. Apparently attached to the nauseating swirls his mind places before him. How can it end? It says, God placed man in the garden as he does do now when he busies himself with Torah and mitzvahs. By turning our minds and bodies towards righteousness, the jungle of exile melts into the very paradise of the first man. It is well within the reach of everyone. It is not in the heavens, but right here on earth. 57. Consider, how does the Torah differ from the teachings of the simple pantheist? The Torah says all is God, and the pantheist says all is God. While the Torah teaches that God is all, it also teaches that God is only, and that one must not worship a portion of the all, be it an angel or a power or even a spirit. The simple pantheist equates God with the forces of nature and thereby feels free to worship this force in any of its forms. He says that since God is omnipresent, he is correct in worshiping the presence within a rock or a table. This is idolatry and will lead to an endless maze. As we discussed above, the all is the particular, but the particular is not all. The omnipresent is the particular, but the particular is not omnipresent. The table is not the universe, although the universe is present everywhere. When grabbing a portion, one is grabbing the all, but in worshiping a portion, one is worshiping that portion alone. 58. Consider, what is an angel? The word angel in Hebrew also means messenger. It appears throughout Scripture describing certain occurrences. These sometimes appear in the form of a man or creatures or even as the elements. Are these created beings animated with will, or are these merely mental images formed by the viewer's mind as the need is perceived from above? Great deeds are attributed to angels, such as Raphael, or Uriel, the angel of light. These anthropomorphic descriptions help one to understand the nature of an angelic visit, but also lend to the belief in a system of hierarchy in which subtle beings stand around heaven with feathered wings playing golden harps. It is far more accurate to understand the word angel to mean message than messenger. When God sends three messages to Abraham in the form of three angels, it first states, "And the Lord appeared unto him. And he lifted up his eyes, and behold, three men stood by him." First, God is said to appear, then three men are standing there. Which is it? Did God appear, or did three men appear? The answer becomes clear as the story unfolds. The Lord appears and is giving three messages. Each message is personified by an angel. As Abraham speaks and interacts with these men, sometimes the Torah says, "And they," the men, "said," then later, "Shall I hide from Abram what I am doing?" The story changes from the Lord to the men, to the angels. Finally, three men leave Abraham, and two angels came to Sodom. What happened to the third man? Each message has a specific purpose. One message, and therefore one messenger, came to tell Abraham that his wife would have a child. Once the message was delivered, it had no reason to continue. Therefore, only two went on to Sodom. Seeing that this type of messenger disperses upon completion of its duty reveals its underlying nature. This is like our words, our messages, which also are uniquely formed to go out into the atmosphere and then disperse. The Torah portrays the event in a language most common to us. We are comfortable with the image of men speaking, yet here it is clearly God who is talking. He could have spoken to Abram through a bush, as he does with Moses, or even have a mule speak, as he did with Balaam. But here the need was for men to appear. Each of these examples is designed to teach a specific lesson. While the lesson of the bush is that God is found even in such a lowly place, the lesson taught by using men might very well be to show us how Abraham treated guests, how he ran to serve their every need. Abraham is exemplary of the gracious host desiring only that his guests have their needs met. By portraying angels, messengers, as men, we are given this insight into proper behavior. However, the person who assumes angels to be separate beings with independent existence, power or will, has fallen into the anthropomorphic and has forgotten the basic principle, only God is here and there is no other at all. 59. Consider, since there is no other will besides God's will, when a thief climbs into a home at night, this also must be God's will. How can it be said that God wills such evil? God fills the universe. Life, which is God, fills every nook and cranny. Just as God has free will, so does free will permeate all of creation. However, creation is set so that each thing behaves within its defined limits. This means that a rock does not, within the natural scheme of creation, speak. However, this does not exclude the possibility of rock speaking. Creation, although housing free will, acts as if it had no choice. Man, however, is distinguished within creation by his ability to manifest what appears to be self-will freely. This is what is meant by God created man in his image. The burglar had the choice to break into the house or not. The rock does not have the choice to sit there or not. Although free will is actually everywhere, it is designed to manifest only in man. As man chooses either good or evil, this is life in man choosing. God has allocated to himself the role of man choosing good or evil. "I place before you life or death, so choose life," it says. When the man chooses good, it is God in man as man choosing good. If a particular man chooses evil, this is also God choosing that. As it says, "If I lie in the grave, you are also there." The universal will is what makes a flower turn toward the sun or a rock roll down the hill. The one will permeates all. And even though a person is locked into his individual perspective, he is no more acting as a separate being than are the fingers of the hand acting as separate beings. So how can God allow evil to exist? Would it not have been a more wonderful creation without the choice of evil? Without choices, life would clearly be entirely different. However, God has created a certain progression that requires man to choose and to experience the repercussions of his choice. This is the process we are faced with. We must learn to choose correctly or pay the consequences. Evil is not an entirely separate aspect of creation. Just as left and right are merely different ends of the same body, so are good and evil different directions of the same action. It is interesting that the reverse spelling of live in English spells evil. Even from this, it can be seen that evil is not a separate power. The same will fills either choice, either direction. One leads to life, and the other leads to death. 60. Consider, what time is it? From the beginning of creation till now, 96% of the time required for the Messiah to come has passed. The year 6000 in the Hebrew calendar is the latest that he will come. The first 6000 years of creation can be likened to the first 6 days of the week, so that the next 1000 years become like the Sabbath. In the cosmic time frame, 5750, which was 1990, began Friday afternoon. This is when we finalized preparations for the Sabbath. Much has been completed. Shopping, washing, cleaning, and most of the cooking has been done. Now it is time to gather our clothes in order to go to the mikveh. This is how we purify ourselves to receive the holiness of the day. It is the essence of our age. We must gather our clothes, which are our deeds, and we must immerse ourselves in the learning of Torah and the carrying out of its precepts. On the Messiah's clock, we are at least at Friday afternoon, and we must busy ourselves with the preparations for his imminent arrival. We must quicken our pace to assure completion of our task. 61. Consider. The Torah, indeed life, may be discussed from four perspectives. These are described by the Hebrew acrostic Pardes, which stands for Peshat, the literal meaning, Remitz, the illusionary hint, Drush, the homiletic, and Sod, the underlying or esoteric. The Peshat is the perspective all people know. This is the literal, or that which can be seen. At this perspective, the nature of an object or occurrence is described by its physical appearances, that is, the physical table. The Remitz, the hint or illusion, describes the table by its use, such as the table being used for Sabbath meals and therefore likened to an altar. The similarity of a table to an altar in both appearance and in use leads us to consider and treat the table as such. Because of these similarities, we infer additional meanings and thus affect the way we use the table. Just as we would never offer a non-kosher offering upon an altar, we would never place anything non-kosher upon our tables. Since we salted our sacrifice, we now dip our bread in salt, and so on. Next, the perspective of Drush. Here, the homiletic or expounded meaning is drawn out. Since the table is a type of altar, and since we must behave in a certain way before approaching an altar, while serving on it, and even after we leave it, we expound that we must also behave in an appropriate way before approaching a table, a meal, while we are dining, and after we finish the meal. For instance, before making a sacrifice in the temple, the priest would wash his hands. Likewise, before eating bread, we also wash our hands. Since the table is considered to be an altar, we must behave at the table as if we are offering upon an altar. Thus, we not only conclude, as we did by allusion, that the table is a type of an altar, but we further expound that a Jewish table has requirements of service just like a Jewish altar. Just as we would be obligated to proceed in a proper order at an altar, we must also act appropriate when eating. Finally, we may discuss the table from the perspective of Sod, or the esoteric. Here we recognize that in order for a physical table to be manifesting in the physical realm, first there must be a spiritual table manifesting in the spiritual realm. The spiritual table is formulated as its name or concept is drawn together. Only after this is done can there be the possibility of a physical table. After the physical table manifests, the spiritual table does not cease to exist, but rather the spiritual table actually sustains its physical likeness. This can be more easily understood by considering the relationship of ongoing thought to ongoing deed, somewhat like an artist's brush being directed by his thoughts. However, when the artist stops his directing thought, only his future strokes are interrupted. Those already drawn stay on the canvas. This is so because the lines are made from ink, which existed before he used it. His thoughts do not create the ink, but merely cause it to be reshaped into strokes. However, the cessation of the spiritual thought would not only prevent any future physical strokes, but would also erase those already drawn. This is so because the physical is actually made up of the spiritual and is therefore sustained by it. Liken this to turning off a flashlight, which not only prevents the continuation of future rays, but also eliminates the existing ray. How is this information of use to us who deal in the everyday physical world? We must realize that this physical environment is actually the spiritual being brought down into a physical realm. The food we eat causes a transfer of the spiritual and the physical, from names to molecules, from energy to deeds. As the food we eat becomes energy in our bodies, we're able to maintain life. By taking in this sustenance with a memory of its creator, the act of eating becomes elevated into a spiritual experience. Food taken with a spiritual hope will produce a better opportunity to use its energy spiritually in order to enjoy God's presence on earth. The table was brought into creation, manifesting first as will, then name, then light, then through various stages until it is finally formed materially in a manner appropriate to serve in the daily service of God. Metal or molecules, we can see this phenomena as table, altar, place of divine service, or molecules stacked and floating in a certain pattern, supported by its spiritual purpose. Each perspective is true. Each exists. None of the perspectives stop existing while we discuss the next. When we say molecules, the table does not cease to exist. And when we say altar, the molecules do not cease to exist. We merely change our focus or depth of perception. So it is with all of creation. Whether we wish to call each person man or molecules, each person is both. Whether we wish to call the earth dirt or holy, both are there, and we are expressing our experiences or points of view by labeling what we see. We're not changing what is there, although we do bring into creation what we emphasize. By judging a man as good, we draw upon that goodness. As it says, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is filled with his glory." The entire world is filled and imbued with holiness. The table is holy. The altar is holy. The order is holy, the molecules are holy, and certainly the spiritual essence is holy. This holiness permeates all perspectives, as we realize that we also cannot be excluded from this holiness. Our awareness is elevated from the mere physical to include the spiritual. 62. Consider viewing a photograph of the planet Earth taken from the moon diminishes our sense of self-importance. Normally, we are entrenched in our own regard for our own little worlds, each existing as the center of an ongoing collision between me and it. We carry this center with us, and at any given moment, we can recite our woes and hopes as if these were the major occurrences of the generation. Looking at the photograph of the moon from the Earth, we are still firmly the all-important center, with the moon being a rather small white dot in our sky. However, in the photograph of the planet Earth taken from the moon, we now become not only the viewer, but a microscopic speck in a view. It is difficult to locate our tiny portion of the world, let alone our problems. This shift is an easy exercise in moving from the ego I to a more universal it perspective. Both perspectives are important, and when we realize that we are the it as well as the we do not discard the we. We simply broaden our scope more and more until finally our egos become harmless appraisals of our current opinions of our lives. Then we will have rid ourselves of many negative and depressing habits, such as harsh self-judgment or puffy pride. 63. Consider, the difference between love and lust is that love says, be blessed, be happy, be free, while lust says, just come to me. 64. Consider, why are we here? To argue if we are here is fruitless. There are arguments that claim this life is but a dream without meaning, and at any moment we might awaken only to find that our life experiences have been for naught. Existence proves its purpose by merely being, the fact that something is going on, or else how could we discuss it, is apparent. Whether it is a dream or not does not take away from its existence. Dreams also exist. In fact, the Torah says that this life is but a dream when we compare it to the redeemed life awaiting us in the world when the Messiah comes. Now we see life through distracted and clouded minds. Everything is interpreted according to our needs and past experiences. We cling to things today that in the age of the redemption will seem to be tinsel and trash. Such things as prestige and fame today are held up to be reason enough to justify lifetimes of building or destroying. Wars have been fought for less. However, when the final peace comes to this world, every man will know God. Will one who knows the eternal truth be concerned with prestige or fame? These will be seen to be what they actually are. Obstacles to peace. Whether this is an awakened life or a dream life or any other type of existence is not the subject at hand. Whatever we choose to call existence, we find ourselves wrapped up in it, and now the question is why. Although why questions lead to additional whys, answering the primordial why God creates the universe, should satisfy our minds. God creates the universe with its almost infinite variety to create joy. Joy is the goal, and joy is the means. Life, though now beginning with pain, is to give joy. Death, though painful for those left behind, is for joy. Health is for joy, and even its opposite is for joy. The right and the left, the up and the down, the hard and the soft, all of the choices are here, so we will choose the better for a joyous result. This is the reason, and this can be the moment. By choosing the path that brings a lasting joy, we see God's holy plan while right here on earth. Joy. 65. Consider. Is it conceivable that people in one city can have extra food and destroy their surplus, while other people in a nearby area are starving to death? This is going on today all over the world. People are not starving because there's not enough food. There is more livable uninhabited land than there is inhabited land, and there is more than enough food available to support all of the world's populations. So what will it take to solve this? A prophet once said, "And man will beat his swords into plowshares." 66. Consider. When a student of Hebrew begins the study of the Aleph Beis, there's an encouraging message waiting there. The first two letters, Aleph Beis, spell the word Av, Father. The next two letters, Gimel Dalet, spell God, good fortune. So it is when a person embarks on a lifelong study in the Hebrew language. Indeed, he should look up and say, Father, good fortune has come. For this is the first step in a journey of holy revelations accessible only through the knowledge of Hebrew. The day the Torah was translated into another language is considered to be a tragic day. This is not because knowledge of God's revelations to the Jewish people became readily available to the nations of the world, as this could only serve the avenues of world peace. But by removing the original Hebrew, the Torah becomes a watered-down, vague interpretation, highly subject to misunderstanding. And perhaps even more tragic is that the awe that accompanies the Hebrew is gone. Even the literal storyline fails, how much more so the underlying subtlety. Picture a synthetic vitamin made to deliver a certain number of units of vitamin A. Even if this chemical could deliver the delivered vitamin A, look what has been lost when compared to eating a carrot. The taste, the bulk, the sight, the hardness, the moisture, the accompanying vitamins and minerals, the saliva and other digestive juices, until we conclude that when we want vitamin A, we should reach for a carrot instead of a chemical. Without the Hebrew, most of the essential aspects of Torah are missing, such as numerical values. Each Hebrew letter is also a number, and by studying the numerical values, much is learned about the meaning of the word. Also lost is the study of the shapes of the letters, which reveal hidden meanings. Even the location of the ink on the page is revealing. The tiny crowns on the letters, the tune to which the words are sung, the previous or following word can be divided or joined, thus affecting meaning. The pronunciation can change a word entirely. These are but a few of the essentials lost when the Torah is taken out of Hebrew and placed into another language. The only proper way to study the Torah is to begin with the Aleph Beis. Then you will not only learn the words God spoke to Moses, but you will hear them, and you will slowly submerge yourself in their wisdom and clothe yourself in good deeds. Your children will continue in goodness, and you will live to see many happy years. As it says, "And he places me among the princes of his people. He lifts me up and replaces my mourning with dancing." 67. Consider. Shall we fight to save the whales? Shall we give money to save the sea turtles? Shall we give time and energy to keep the endangered species among the living? Are these important enough to care about? Is it not all the more important for the Jew to survive? Every living Jew, no matter who, is already a survivor. A survivor of the Cainite, a survivor of the Egyptians, a survivor of the Midianites and the Philistines, the Amalekites and the Ammonites, the Moabites and the Edomites, of Romans and Armenians, and the Assyrians, Babylonians, Persians, Greeks, Spanish, Goths, Franks, Portuguese, Russians, Poles, Prussians, and Germans and Arabs. And perhaps now we have the most difficult survival test of all, the survival from prosperity. As it says, and you grew fat and kicked, then forsook God who made you, and provoked him with strange gods, and the Lord abhorred you. Number 68. Consider. Do not follow after your own heart and your own eyes, after which you will go astray. With these words, the Torah warns not to do what seems so natural. Is it not our heart that tells us right from wrong? How can we refuse to believe our innermost feelings, our very being? Is this not the center our systems must answer to? It may seem that to cut off our heart would leave us floating in a mind-centered maze, bouncing off opinions. But we must decide which is reliable, our heart and senses, or our ancient Torah. Some years ago, there lived a Jewish man who set out to find spiritual truth. He opened an Indian import shop, so it was only natural for him to read the Eastern philosophies. Impressed with what he found, he began an intense regime of exercises, fasts, and chants. After some time, he noticed a power had developed that began as a slight buzzing. It started to move around his body, and finally increased to the point that others could feel it while standing next to him. This caused the group to flock around him, and he became their spiritual leader. The power increased and became quite strong, but then it began to come and go. When it came, he felt a great sense of well-being. When it left, he felt as if his life was draining out of his body through his fingertips. He became weak and confused. To find an answer to what had become the most crucial problem of his life, he traveled to India. He had heard of an accomplished master, and with no apparent alternative, he endured the hardships of travel and sought him out. He found the master surrounded by many disciples. He followed all of the required customs to approach him, and when he finally gained his approval, he asked his question, "How can I stop the feeling that my life is draining out through my fingers?" The master smiled and said, "That is easy. Simply touch your forefingers to your thumbs and it will stop." He touched his forefingers to his thumbs, and the draining sensation stopped. He fell on his face and kissed the master's feet and said, "You are my master. You have saved my life." The group of disciples sighed, "How great is our master." The older disciples explained to the younger initiates that by touching their forefingers to the thumb, their life force energy is recycled back into the body. All were happy. All understood the great wisdom of the East. A new disciple had come, his heart and senses confirmed that his life had been saved. He knew he was doing the right thing. Now, let us look at this wisdom. Is it so wise that a man should have to walk through life, touching his thumbs to his forefingers in order to hold his life within his body? Does this make any sense at all? He was in trouble, and his solution actually deepened his quandary. His heart and his senses told him that he was healed. But his healing caused him to spend the next 15 years, almost until the day of his death, following a man who told him, "Simple, just touch your forefingers to your thumbs." In California, there lived an assimilated Jewish family. The wife decided to find spiritual truth, and much like the man whose life was draining out of his fingers, she began by reading books on various religions and disciplines. She answered an ad in a magazine promising to unlock the secrets of the power of the mind. They sent her books describing the untapped psychic power of her psychic mind. It was so fascinating that she began to become engrossed in the books and tried all of the exercises they recommended. "This is so wonderful," she thought. "Why isn't this taught to the children in school?" She became very successful in her practices. Her psychic power increased by leaps and bounds until, finally, she could know the thoughts of those around her by simply looking into her mind. She understood things undiscernible by the normal senses. People were amazed and began to cling to her to learn about her spiritual truth. She became an exalted teacher with a deep respect of many people who asked her advice on all sorts of matters. All was fine for a while, but then it became impossible to turn off the clairvoyance. It became more and more disturbing until her mind was affected. Voices became thoughts and thoughts became voices until she could not tell if what she was thinking was her own thoughts or those of the people standing around her. She became mentally unbalanced. Her husband was drifting away and the family prepared for a divorce. Although she truly wanted to continue in her role as a spiritual guide, her family meant more, so she agreed to seek help. But where could she find it? Certainly if she, the major psychic in the area, did not understand what was going on, then no one would. She longed for a normal life, but no matter how hard she tried to leave her power, it would not leave her. None of the books could explain this phenomenon, and she became frantic. No one knew the answer. Desperate, with nowhere else to turn, she went to a rabbi well known for his wisdom. "Rabbi," she began, "how can I control my psychic power? It's ruining my life." He said, "You go home and keep the laws of kosher to the very absolute letter, and the power will go away within 3 days. She went away entirely skeptical, certain that his solution had nothing to do with her problem. But the thought of losing her mind and marriage was too much for her. She would try anything, even what obviously could not work. She went home and began what seemed like a senseless task. A task without reason. Meat on this side, milk on the other, new dishes, blowtorch the oven, boiling water for the counters, throw out a lot of apparently good food, go through the cabinets, the pantry, even the aluminum foil. My God, she screamed, is there any end to all of this nonsense? Her mind would wander off, but she could not space out too far, or else she would forget if that was a milk or meat spoon in her hand. She struggled to keep her attention on the problem at hand. She made mistakes, screamed a lot, but finally ended up with a kosher house. And by the end of 3 days, the clairvoyance stopped. No one could have been more amazed. Was the rabbi some great psychic in disguise? Or maybe he was just a vision and was not really there. He was not a psychic, nor was he a vision. He was just a wise person who knew that God has sent us here to be involved with earthly things. For the rabbi, it was to run a synagogue with its thousands of problems that forbade floating off. For a Jewish housewife, it is the laws of kashrut that provide a grounding bond. He could see that she had developed her problem with her mind, and it was her mind that was sustaining it. He knew from his own experience that, by being an attentive Jew, observant of all the Jewish laws, there could be no time to indulge oneself in floating around the cosmos. She needed to become grounded back onto the world to which she was sent. As for her husband, he has returned not only to his wife, but also to a Torah-observant life. The family is finally at peace. What sometimes seems to be right in our heart does not always work out. Emotions cloud reason. New experiences can be tricky without a base to draw upon. Having a wise old friend to point out the safe way is certainly a precious gift. The Torah is such a friend. Its wisdom will endure even after gold fails. As it says, not by power, not by might, but by spirit, says the Lord. Number 69. Consider, when a Jew prays, he sometimes rocks back and forth. At times, he rocks gently, reminiscent of rocking a baby, and at times, he sways with great fervor and intensity. Then all of a sudden, the tempo switches, his arms raise, he twists from side to side with a glowing look of contentment. What is happening? The rocking back and forth is like a pump. The water is the Torah, and it needs to be brought to the surface of his mind. Like water, when it comes to the surface, it spreads. So the Jew, after pumping, turns from side to side, spreading the water around. 70. Consider. On Friday, early afternoon, a small car would back up to the entrance of the Kotel, a most unusual occurrence reserved for only the most revered or the severely infirmed. The doors would spring open, and what seemed to be more people than could possibly fit piled out of the back of the car, and soon stood by as an old man slowly moved from the car to a seat by the Kotel. He looked kind, but old age always seemed to look kind around the Kotel. He looked simple, and were it not for his somewhat unusual dress, he would not have stood out in a crowd. He wore an outfit typical of Jews from ancient Yerushalayim or from nearby Arab countries, a robe instead of the normal jacket or formal long coat worn by most observant Jews of European traditions. I watched to see if I was to extend help or to receive it. The question became quickly answered as a stream of men lined up in front of him and waited happily in line. The simple joy so easily demonstrated by the Sephardim always made me feel somewhat stilted with my own sharpened analytical mind and emotions. They seemed to skip through the day while I was stuck carrying it out. One by one they shuffled closer, chattering excitedly. As each approached, I watched carefully, a trait I thank God for dearly, and learned how to receive what this old man was given. A man would approach, take the old man's hand, kiss it gently, move it directly to his closed eyes, and then place it on top of his head and ask for a blessing. And so it went, the line waxing and waning, Sephardim, soldiers, children, Hasidim, Ashkenazim, each would approach in his own way. The Sephardim kiss, most Ashkenazim shake hands, the humble ask, the proud tell, and I watched until at last it was my turn, and I followed the custom I felt was best for me. He looked so simple, I thought. But who can tell how a blessing is supposed to look? I reached out for his hand and kissed it gently, touched it to my eyes. May God let me see. I placed it on my head. May God bless me. He intoned a blessing, and I moved on, watching as one after another became happy because this kind old man said, God bless you. Abba Sephardi, Yaakov ben Mazel Tov, may he be remembered for a blessing. 71. Consider. The car bounced along the road toward Beth Sheva. It felt like an outing or a class project. I had not traveled in a passenger car for almost a year, and memories were flooding in. Car trips were always comfortably exciting, protected from the elements while zooming through new terrain. The terrain here was dry, desert dry, yet settlement after settlement popped up, sporting full green gardens, groves, even tiny lawns. Israel is Israel. A good feeling. There were four of us in the car, each pursuing a dream. We were going to have our prayers answered, the most wonderful, the most personal, the most pressing. Each of us was searching our minds. Did we leave anything off our list? Should there be a list at all? Wouldn't a single request be more favorably and more swiftly answered than an entire list of quibbles? Would I ask an earthly king just for my life and be thankful? or once I have my foot in the door, should I spill out all of my desires? The car pushed me first against the door and then back against Shmuel, my friend from the yeshiva. We smiled, feeling it a little too early to congratulate ourselves on our answered prayers, yet not wanting to show skepticism, lest it would affect the outcome of our journey. We each had an empty bottle to be filled with water when we arrived. It didn't make sense, but these things never do. 40 years, Baruch broke the silence. He was in the wilderness for 40 years, just like the Jews after leaving Egypt. I didn't feel like answering, preferring to stay in my mind, organizing my priorities, but Baruch was our host. It was his car, and I didn't want to offend him. He never came into the city, I chimed in. Shmuel's turn. His father was even greater. That was true, but it also dampened slightly what we had. Shmuel recouped. The day he walked into the village, it was like a holiday. Everyone thought the Messiah had come. The entire village stopped working and gathered around. I heard it said, Baruch's wife was talking, his blessings never go unanswered. With that, silence could return. We went over our list again, and for the fourth time made sure that we had brought our bottles. The car squeaked to a stop. The building was smaller than I had imagined, but the crowd was not. We quickly filled our bottles with tap water and took our places in what looked like a crowded waiting room at a Mideastern airport or a medical clinic. We waited and waited and waited. Then at last what pretended to be a line began to move. Then it moved swiftly. I entered the room where Baba Sali was lying down. His entire body was covered with a white sheet. He was over 90 years old, and apparently he rarely got up from bed. An aide took my bottle of water and my note. He held the water up over Baba Sali and read the note rather loudly into his ear. Baba Sali responded with a muffled omen, and our words urged on and out. Phew, I thought, that's it? Hours of travel, hours of waiting, and seconds of seeing a white sheet? My mind would have liked to make light of what had just happened, but my experiences over the past years of searching had taught me better. The ride back to Yerushalayim was quick and chatty. No one dared to question what had occurred, but no one was amazingly impressed either. A few days later, Shmuel came running up to me. You wouldn't believe it, he exclaimed. I mean, if I had drank the water, having been there and all, then I could see something happening, but my son wasn't even there. Shmuel, you have to give me more information. I'm not following you, I said. All the way to Baba Sali, he continued, I thought. Am I asking right? I mean, this sounds like such a little thing, but to us it's been a major problem. Shmuel stopped and looked at me as if I could understand. Shmuel, I said in a tone one step under annoyance. He quickly continued. My son started wetting the bed, night after night, and we don't have a washing machine, so this has been a major hassle. The whole family has been bent out of shape over this, and then he drank the water from Baba Sali, and he wasn't even there. He just drank the water without knowing that it was any different from just plain tap water, and now he has stopped wetting the bed. It's a miracle. He hasn't wet the bed in 3 nights. My heart smiled. Of course I was happy for Shmuley's family, but I also knew that my blessing was on its way. 72. Consider. I've been to 770 dozens of times. Each time my experience of what is there grows and deepens, but no time has equaled the first. I stood outside and waited for the Rebbe to come. I was there for several hours, watching the Hasidim hurry through their day. I wondered why such a great man insisted on housing his followers in this tiny Brooklyn oasis surrounded by so many hostile blacks. The Rebbe came, whisked by, and disappeared into 770 Eastern Parkway. I waited, and then the strains of men's voices singing or chanting seeped through the swinging doors and out onto the street. I left the dark street and walked into the glowing room. The bright lights reflected off the several thousand bright bearded faces. It was elbow to elbow, front to back, absolutely packed. There was not room for even one more person, yet they still poured in past me. It was like a sea of black coats, black hats, black beards, and glistening faces. As though this was not unusual enough, they were also singing a melody unlike any that I had ever heard. It had no words, but it gave a feeling of lifting. Then it began. As if by some unseen sign, the music became high enough to lift its singers and they began to jump up. They sprang up and sailed down in unison. Thousands of black coats and shining faces, up, 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 and then down, up, 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 and then down. The entire building began to tremble as the music became louder, up and down. Yah, 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 yah. They were singing, floating, shining, up, up, and then from the platform, the Rebbe raised his fist and whipped it in the air. Like a well-trained team of thousands of horses, the whip spurred them on to explosive heights. I could see the Baal Shem Tov flying over the crowd, his whacking driver whipping the air, spurring on the horses as they swooped down and out through the swinging doors onto the streets of exile, headed to save some poor or helpless Jew. 73. Consider, the Torah is not merely a historical record. Most important, it functions as a teaching tool for the living. We must be able to learn from the lessons of the past to be able to apply these very lessons to our daily lives. How then do we explain such occurrences as David slaying Goliath? Are we expected to find an evil one-eyed giant and come against him? Armed only with a slingshot? Yes. Not only must we find him and even slay him, but we must do this every day of the work week. To teach us, the Torah writes of the David who lived thousands of years ago to the David who is living today. Each of the personalities described in the Torah are also manifested in their descendants today. So what appears to be a simple Jew living today is in reality the manifestation of Abraham's hospitality, Yitzchak's righteousness and submissiveness, and Yaakov's striving and overcoming. Here's also Adam, Moshe and Aaron, David and Shlomo, all of our ancestors. This is made evident when we pray on Sabbath afternoon. Abraham rejoices, Yitzchak exults, Yaakov and his sons rest thereon. All this is in the continuous present tense. If this were merely a historical reference, it would be in the past tense. But here we are told that our ancestors are and will enjoy Shabbos. What of David? Historically, David as a youth fought and destroyed the evil giant Goliath. He did this armed with a mere slingshot. First, David knocked out the braggart by slinging a stone to his forehead, hitting him right between his eyes. Then David took the giant's own sword and decapitated him, annihilating the evil, much to the joy of the Israelites who were watching from the background. Once the giant was dead, his followers fled for their lives with the Israelites in hot pursuit. History without present application may as well be fiction, mere whimsy, but the Torah has not been vouchsafed for the past several thousand years without intending, pressing, and explicit instructions for each generation. As the Torah says, throughout your generations, to live by, and each generation shall read the Passover story as if he is reliving the experiences today. Today, each Jewish man is obligated to reenact the battle of David and Goliath each weekday of his adult life. We all have the inclination to do good or evil. David represents the good within us, and the inclination towards evil is our own personal Goliath. The battle begins with the evil inclination, raising its huge and ugly head. The tactics employed by each man's Goliath will vary with the individual. Some will be subtle and merely suggest sleeping late, while others will roar and emphatically state, "There's no way I'm going to follow these senseless laws." Both are equally dangerous, and if any David weakens, the giant may eventually overtake him, until David himself takes on the characteristics of a Goliath. The remedy is to sling a rock right between the eyes of the evil inclination. The sling today is tefillin, leather boxes containing parchments with certain commandments written upon them. These boxes are bound to the arm next to the heart and upon the head between the eyes. The rock is his word, firm and unchanging. by submitting to the Torah, by binding its words upon our arms, that means our actions, and by placing them as reminders between our eyes, which means in our mind, we subjugate the evil inclination to the Torah's righteousness. Goliath's strength is his ability to wreak havoc by causing an evil response to follow an evil deed. If actions did not produce similar reactions, Goliath would be relatively impotent, but each deed brings of its own kind a similar deed, and because of this, his strength can become enormous. This strength, or sword, is what can cut off its own head. By doing a good deed instead of an evil one, by forcing the evil inclination to submit to donning tefillin, a chain reaction of goodness becomes initiated. As the main obstacle to goodness falls, all of its army of lesser evils flee for their lives. At the same time, the good deed is reinforced by the ensuing waves of additional good deeds that result from obeying the commandment of tefillin. These will sweep in, and Goliath's army will be put to the sword.
ThereIsOne.com